Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the line is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, whichever it is, whenever you're hearing this.
Or good evening, good night.
Yeah, right.
So, Caroline, who do we have with us today on Writers' Voices?
Well, today we have a very interesting book, Animals I Want to See. And by the title, you can think, oh, my goodness, what is this about? Well, I'll tell you. This gentleman, Tom Seaman, grew up in a family of 14 on welfare and food stamps in the projects of Toledo, Ohio, and went on to own and to lead several businesses. He earned his BA in economics from Yale, where he rode on the crew team and graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa before going on to earn his Juris Doctor at Harvard Law. Well, this gentleman, talk about work ethic. I'm telling you, it's been amazing. He has an amazing childhood and an amazing life. And right now he is living in Massachusetts with his wife, 4 children, 3 dogs and a cat. And you're going, this book is one that you read it and then you have to start over and read it again because it's so interesting. That's what I did. So anyway.
So it's Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds by Tom Seaman. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Tom.
Well, thank you for having me.
So one thing that amazed me was, so the book starts when you're about how old? 6?
Seven.
And the level of detail that you seem to recall about your childhood, how in the world did you remember so much?
Well, I would say, first of all, there's 14 of us in the family. So I did interview each of the family members and got some memories reminded to me from them. And also, you know, because we are a pretty close family, we still get together every year, all of us at Thanksgiving in Toledo, where my mom at 92 is still alive. So we all pull together and we talk about these family stories endlessly over and over again. So a lot of it is just been rehashed and, you know, so we're very familiar with the stories. And then a few of the memories I have had my whole life. And then a few of the memories came from siblings and family members that we interviewed. I also interviewed my high school crew, you know, and everybody. So I got a lot of reminders of things from that as well.
What inspired you to want to write about your childhood?
Yeah, so, you know, I've had some success in business. And so, you know, I live much better now than I used to. I don't live in the projects anymore. And I would, you know, be at a dinner party or something and I would tell a story of my background and people were always extremely surprised and they wanted to hear more about it because they had probably painted a picture in their mind of me as having grown up, you know, upper middle class in Greenwich, Connecticut or something like that. And here they're finding, they never would have created the story in their mind that I grew up in the project somewhere in this giant family. So I began to realize the story was really interesting and inspirational in many ways. And then I was at an event where I was talking to President Clinton, and I'd met him a few times in my life, and he was very focused on me about my story. You know, he's famous for being able to focus on whoever he's talking to, and this was very true. And he had grown up poor too, and he loved the story. He talked to me for quite a while, and he said, you have to write this book. So I got down to business and started writing the book. And then when I finished it, I contacted President Clinton and said, hey, I remember you told me to write this book. I wrote this book. So will you give me a blurb? Will you give me a statement of support for the book? So he read the book and he said, yes, I will. And so that blurb now appears on the cover of the book, as you can see.
Right, right. And you've got blurbs from some other really prominent people as well.
Yes. For example, Deepak Chopra has also blurbed the book. Yes.
Yes. And how did you know him?
I actually know he has one brother, and I know his brother quite well. And so he got the book to Deepak, and Deepak also agreed to blurb it because I think partly because it fits with part of Deepak's philosophy, which is all about inspiration and other things. And so he blurbed the book as well. Yes.
Wow.
He liked what he read. I like to believe.
Well, what's not to like, really? It's a very,
really, yes,
it's a fascinating story. One thing I've said this before, that we often have kind of an idealized perspective of large families. I think it came from the Walton family, you know, that TV show back in the day where but most of the large families that I know anything about, it was not an ideal environment for children. And I think that was in many ways true in your story. And yet, like at the end of your book, you mentioned that all 12 of you have had successful lives.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your definition of success, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I would attribute the difficulty in our family came from my father, who was an alcoholic, but separate from being an alcoholic, he was also a mean guy, you know? And I think he was that way because he didn't like his life. You know, he didn't like the way his life turned out. He didn't have a lot of success, and he took that out on his family. On the other hand, my mother, you know, comes out in the book, and it's very true, as almost a saint, you know, a very hard worker, very committed to keeping the family together, because a family like this can fall apart in the projects with an alcoholic father. Very committed to that. And I would say about her, a person who would go the extra mile. So this was a modeling behavior, I think, that affected me and others in my family. My mother, you know, she was really good at, even with the low budget that we had, delivering rounded meals to us, always baking desserts. But when she baked or cooked, she cleaned or anything, she wouldn't just do the norm of what was expected. She would go an extra step. So, for example, making cookies, she could have bought cookies. We never had bought cookies. She could make chocolate chip cookies where you just drop the dough on the platter. She didn't go simple. She would make, for example, pinwheel cookies, which are, you roll out the white dough, you roll out the chocolate dough, then you roll them together, then you slice them, then you cook them. And many examples of these kinds of experiences with her, where she went the extra mile. And then, of course, as soon as she finished making dozens and dozens of cookies for these 12 children, we would consume them in one night, right? They would just all this extra work just to see it disappear immediately. The same with cleaning. You'd come home from school, and she would have the windows out, and she wouldn't just clean the windows. She would have a screwdriver with a rag wrapped around it, cleaning the rungs where the windows go back in, you know, in the projects, which was very uncommon. So we had this modeling from my mother of going the extra mile and seeking excellence, I would say. She was very good at it and was just a great parent. And I think that that in a lot of ways is the reason that we've had success. The last thing I would say is that, you know, the book is really, it's about my life growing up in the projects and this large family, but it's also, I think, a collection of small kindnesses, in the sense that once we got established in our neighborhood and were accepted, it was a black neighborhood. So and we were white. So, you know, at first I took a few punches when we got there. But as we got accepted, you know, the community, we were just part of it. And small kindnesses along the way done for me. For example, the man across the street took three of us, you know, white boys fishing, and the man a couple doors over would barbecue and he would give us a little taste of the meat. Now, these small things maybe don't change a life, but if you add them all up, all the small kindnesses and help that I received along the way, you know, it adds up to a life.
Hmm.
Changes a life.
Yeah. When you were sat down to write this, and you know, you said you did talk to all your siblings, you interviewed them, were there any that, like, Tom, don't do this, don't write this, we don't need to relive, we don't need to air our dirty laundry?
Yes. So a little bit my mother at first, because she's because we've had some success. I've had the most financial success in the family, and you know, I bought her a house in a much nicer neighborhood, and she's lived there for 22 years now. And I think that she's left all that behind and doesn't necessarily want to relive it. But when she read the book, when it was finished, she was very happy with it, because she realized it's not one of these sad stories where, you don't really want to keep reading because it's just bad thing after bad thing, right? There are some bad things that happen in the book, but it's primarily a happy book. It's not only a little bit of a rags to riches story, but I think it's uplifting in the way that I looked at the world, right? I looked at the world with wonder my entire life. Maybe it was innate from when I was born, but I didn't see all the bad stuff as just dragging me down, right? I would lift myself up after bad things, and I saw wonder, for example, in the field behind our house, where I started to discover with my brothers that, hey, if you lifted up this, it was a trash heap, the field. I didn't see it as a trash heap. It was a place where people dumped their stuff, right? And so we would pick up a brick, or we would pick up an old refrigerator door, and there would be a snake or something like that. There would be a rat, frankly. And I began to keep a list of wild animals I have seen. And eventually I lost this list, and I started a new list, a forward-looking list, which is animals I want to see one day. And that's where the title comes from. But for me, it's like a metaphor for all of my hopes and dreams of success, because how could a child in the projects, very young, expect to see animals in the wild one day? You don't have any money. You don't have any real plan to travel the world. But I somehow had this outlook that I would achieve things that would allow me to do this. So that's where the title comes from. I looked at the world with wonder my whole life, and I think I still do, although in the book, I point out the Little Prince in the book, which is a book written by Saint-Exupéry of France, and he points out in that book, or exhibits in that book, that as we age, we lose our sense of wonder. Mm. And I've tried to hang on to that, to look at the world with wonder, because it leads to a happier life.
The other book the other list that you kept as a child, in addition to the animals I want to see, you kept a list of rules for success.
Yes.
And do you still have that list?
I have some of it, and as you see in the book, you know, people might be looking for something really deep in that list. You know, it's pretty simple stuff, because I'm starting this list when I'm a very young person, right? So it's things like be reliable, you know, which isn't an attribute you learn a lot in the projects for whatever reason, but being reliable is such a key to success, you know, showing, getting things done. So I kept multiple lists. I mean, I was a lister, right? I would make a list of what I had to do every day, things like that. So I was very much a lister, very much an organized mind. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm a lister too, but I don't always get everything done. That's the problem.
Yeah, there you go. You got to roll it over to the next day.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So your father in the book, of course, doesn't come off looking very good, but he was deceased by the time you wrote this.
Yes.
Yeah. And were there any good memories of him? Did you? You said one of your sisters had good memories of your dad.
Well, I would say about that, first, there's a passage in the book where I say, I really didn't want to present my father as a one-dimensional character, so I racked my brain and I asked all of my siblings whether they could remember some good things, and there are a few good things in there. If you remember, he had a lot of the answers to Jeopardy. He was clearly a smart guy. I have a little sidestep chapter where he does the human flagpole, where he can hold himself up from a pole sideways, and I say, you know, who knew that he had that strength in him, because we were used to looking at him negatively. And so I asked all of my siblings for good memories, and my one sister remembers something that to me is questionable, because nobody else remembers it. And it would be so uncharacteristic of my father to say, "I love you, Mudja," which is what she claimed he called her. But I felt that I should include it, because it's something that I heard from one of my siblings, and I wanted to try to be fair. But my father was, in the memory of everybody else, you know, a pretty negative force in our lives. But as I also say in the book, he can be seen as a positive force, because there's that scene in the fourth grade where we're at, each of the kids in the class is asked by our teacher to say one great thing each parent has given to us. And each of the kids stands up and says all these flowery things to the point of, you know, maybe being unrealistic because they want to say nice things. And I stand up and I say, the greatest thing my mother has ever given me is that she's always there for me, or something like that. And I say, the greatest thing my father has given me as an example, I don't want to be. So in that sense, he played a positive role in my life in that I knew what I wanted to be, but I knew more what I didn't want to be.
Wow.
Well, at least he worked. He had a job, right? He went to work, so that was something.
He did, but he lost a lot of jobs. So he had a lot of jobs. But his longest job was at a cab company, yes. And that's the job that I represent in the book, because it's the longest job that he had. And we remember his activities at that job. That was the longest one, yeah.
And you once took a taxi. He sent a taxi for you when he was working, and you got to hear him working as he was dispatching the taxis over the speaker in the taxi. And that was you got to see a different side of him from that, didn't you?
Yeah. Once again, I tried to point out when I saw him positively. And so he started out as a cab driver, and then he became a dispatcher. And one of the things that his smart mind allowed him to do was he had really memorized the entire map of Toledo. And so when he was a dispatcher, he would not only dispatch cabs, but he would give directions a lot. And you could see his intelligence there. But the sense that I had when I was in that taxi was that here's this voice coming over this radio. It's my dad's voice talking in taxi cab language. They use shorthand a lot. But you could see that he was in control. And I wasn't used to that kind of idea about my father. So I thought including that scene in the book was important to show him actually in control of something and kind of important in a certain role.
I wonder for him if the pressure of that huge family and having to support them was just too much.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of pressure, but that pressure wasn't really felt by my father. I think my mother felt all the pressure of pulling it all together. You know, my father would get a paycheck. He would cash the paycheck. He would only give some of the money to my mother, and he would use the rest. He would drink up the rest, right?
So
it's not like he was this great contributor who really, you know, tried with every fiber of his being to provide for his family. Fortunately, there was, you know, there were programs. There was Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, which, you know, provided for families like ours with food stamps, with welfare, with housing. So obviously we had a lot of governmental help, and, you know, we like to think that we performed well enough that I hope people think that's worth investing in the poor. Some people really make something out of it, I guess.
Right. So when you sat down to write this book, did you write it chronologically? That is how it's written, or it's published chronologically, but did you write it chronologically?
Yes, I was told. So I did hire a writing coach, I should say, because my style of writing was very businesslike. I've been a business guy my whole life. And when I was writing it, I was finding that things weren't flowing and things, you know, I didn't know how to really connect scenes. So I hired this writing coach who is a published author who is anonymous. And she said, well, you know, you're a business guy, and I wouldn't just think that I could come into business and know what I'm doing. And she said, I've been writing my whole life. And so I've learned all these skills about how to connect scenes, how to keep the action flowing, how to keep it interesting for the reader. And you can't just come into this and think you can do it. As you've discovered, Tom, you can't do it all by yourself. So she was a tremendous help. So the first thing, but I had been writing it chronologically, yes, because I thought I should get it all on paper, and the easiest way to do it is chronologically. And then I can maybe shift it around if I wanted to do it from a, you know, started at a later phase and flashback or something like that. But in the end, we determined that the best way was to go chronological. It was the best way to tell the story of coming from one place and getting to another.
So the book starts with your family moving to this particular house. What was different about this from where you had lived before?
So we were living in the projects in an area of Toledo called Ravine Park, which I went back to it recently, by the way. I was in Toledo I was actually filmed there by a TV crew walking through the old projects. Ravine Park is a large area of projects with a lot of brick buildings that were, when I was there, they've changed them, but when I was there, they were flat roof, they were very simple, there were no trees anywhere, no plantings, it was very barren. And there's a picture in the beginning of the book of what it looked like when we were there. You see six of us kids there in front of the projects. And you lived in one third of a building. So as our family was getting bigger at the beginning of the book, I think we have 9 kids in the family going on to 12. And it was incredibly tiny. So my mother applied for a new house in a different area of the projects, North Toledo, where you would get your own house. Even though it was a relatively small house, it was your own house. And so the book starts when I'm 7 years old and we're moving from one area of projects to another area of projects. The main difference being there was more space outside. There were a few trees. there were, you know, you had your own house. Each person, each family had their own house. And it was an area of projects that were running down one street. So Ravine Park had a lot of different streets altogether. It was a neighborhood, whereas Bronson Street is one street with project houses running up and down the street on both sides, with a few regular houses mixed in at certain places where the city, I guess, didn't acquire that land or something. So it was different. Like Ravine Park, it was a primarily Black neighborhood, but the new area was also next to a white neighborhood. So there's a lot about the book about crossing from our neighborhood into the neighborhood where my school was, which was more of a white neighborhood.
And you were going to Catholic schools.
Yeah, so my mother was able to get us the opportunity to go to these Catholic schools without paying for them by asking the priest if we could, and he agreed that we could if we worked at the school. So from a very young age, frankly from third grade, I was a janitor at my school, and in the summers, some of us would spend the whole summer, you know, cleaning the school really intensively. And there's a lot of scenes about my job as a janitor, because once again, rather than seeing it as a negative, I found great joy in it. I would go the extra mile. When I'm cleaning the bathroom, I would reach behind the toilet and clean where no one would see. I really did these things. It's how I looked at the world. Once again, partially because of my mother, but partly I think it was inside of me, you know, somehow this always doing things well and right. And eventually, of course, that gets noticed by others, and it can lead to others then sort of adopting you or doing good things for you and trying to help you in your path of life. That's part of the trail of kindnesses that I talk about in the book.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Tom Seaman, author of Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Yeah, I printed out an excerpt. I hope it's not too long. If it is, maybe I'll stop at some point. But what I have here is the beginning of the book, and then I jump to future chapters at certain points. So I think you'll begin to see the story developing, but there are some discontinuities in it because I jump around. So I'll start. I'm 13 years old, and I could kill someone. I don't mean hypothetically. I mean there's a reasonable chance that I could cause someone to die. But this possibility doesn't occur to me as I heave pumpkins off a bridge and into traffic with my friends. The four of us call ourselves the Halves because two of us are Black and two of us are white. It's 1972, just past dusk, days after Halloween, and the jack-o'-lanterns we've swiped from strangers' yards now explode onto the highway, igniting a ruckus of swerving and honking while we rain above, practically vibrating from an eruption of chemicals, adrenaline, endorphins, testosterone, that are telling us a story. Even kids from the projects can be powerful. I don't realize then that the bridge we're standing on is a metaphor. On one side of it looms prison, despair, hunger of all sorts. On the other, freedom, pleasure, and the untold treasures that come from living a purposeful life. Which way will I go? Statistics say I will not choose widely. For now, I run home to Bronson Street. And then to jump forward, by the time I was in third grade, I'd made some important decisions about my life. Though I'd been planning on being either the heavyweight champion of the world or the richest man in the world since the day Bobo Adams knocked my orange popsicle out of my hand, I'd added one more option, president, because that seemed like the best anyone could be. I'd also been paging through the animal books at school and was already making travel plans for places I would visit. Africa, where cheetahs run as fast as cars. South America, where anteaters scoop up insects with 2-foot tongues. Thailand, where Malayan tapirs whistle and wave their flexible crevasses. And oceans where killer whales breach under the sun. That fall, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Lambert, asked us to write down the greatest thing each of our parents had given us. There were so many things I wanted to say about Mom, but when I thought about Dad, I came up empty. The only thing I could remember him ever giving me was his quote-unquote drops from the bottom of his beer bottles, but that didn't seem like something great. And as my classmates stood up one by one and said flowery things about their parents, sometimes to the point of sounding fabricated, I knew that what I was about to say was going to be different. When my turn came, I stood up and cleared my throat. The greatest thing my mother has given me is that she's always there to help me. And the greatest thing my father has given me, I said nervously, clearing my throat again, is an example of what I don't want to be. Several kids gasped. Mrs. Lambert looked at me wide-eyed, and I wasn't sure if she was stunned or sad. And while what I'd said may not have been what anyone expected to hear, it was the truth, and it marked the beginning of a new kind of life for me. This is jumping forward again. Father Schmelzer was so impressed by the way I cleaned up the holy vomit in church that he asked me if I'd like to take on a summer job with a lot of responsibility, cleaning St. Vincent's School. Mom had told us we'd have to work in exchange for free tuition, so I wasn't surprised. And in that moment, I didn't think about giving up huge swaths of my summer playtime or about whether I would get paid at all, parentheses, I wouldn't, or about how much work it would be, parentheses, a lot. What I thought was how lucky I was to be asked to do such a special job. I took pride in knowing that Father Schmelzer saw something special in me, something my own father couldn't see. After my first few days on the job, I walked beside Mom in the grocery store, my hands next to hers on the cart's cool rail. She was pregnant again. "You wouldn't believe it," I told her. I poured buckets of soapy water all over the floors and sloshed it all around with a mop. And then the head janitor, Mr. Murphy, showed me how to use this big scrubber machine to strip off all the old wax and then suck up all the water with a hose and nozzle. "That's nice," said Mom, inspecting a carton of eggs. The machine was really big, but since I'm probably going to be the heavyweight champion of the world, I was strong enough to handle it. She says, By the time we'd gotten to the checkout line, I'd managed to recount every bit of minutia about my new job that I could think of, while Mom, who spent the lion's share of her life cleaning, listened patiently as I enumerated the joys of janitorial work. The store was bustling that day, with whining toddlers and crying babies, price checks being called out over the intercom, and the long tails of lines wagging out into the store. As we approached the front of the line, Mom accidentally dropped her coupons, which cascaded in several directions all over the floor. I immediately got down and began to gather them, scuttling past grocery cart wheels and people's legs, while farther back in the line, a woman with the kind of hairsprayed hair that a gale force wind couldn't disrupt complained in an arthritic voice, "Hurry it up already. I don't have all day." And when I stood back up, it seemed as if everyone was looking at us and the store had grown quieter. Mom handed the cashier her coupons, and when it came time to pay, Mom took from her wallet neither cash nor a check like other people, but instead booklets of colorful food stamps. She tore along the perforations from each booklet until she'd paid enough. And as the checkout woman gave my mom her change, also in food stamps, my cheeks got hot and my throat got dry. And suddenly I had the urge to hide. I felt as if everyone could see beyond the window of the food stamps into our lives. The rats jumping out of our trash cans, my father slurping duck blood soup, and slurring profanities, my mother silently swallowing his every word.
And that was Tom Seaman reading from Animals I Want to See. So one of the things that you say in the book and that about your siblings say too is that you didn't realize you were poor. Your mother was able to kind of protect you from that realization.
Yes.
Much of the time. And part of it probably helped that, you know, in your neighborhood, everybody was sort of in the same boat. And even though you were going to what your father referred to as a fancy school, at one point you realized it wasn't so fancy compared to many of the other schools.
Right. When we started playing football, me and my brother, we played the other Catholic schools, and we would go to these fields far away from our neighborhood. And the very first game, we were up against a team called St. Pius, which is from a wealthier section of Toledo. And we saw their uniforms and their helmets with cages across their face. And we had very simple old stuff with a single bar across our face. And we had, you know, tattered football pants that were given to us. And they had brand new stuff. But the main thing they had was they had these striped socks that went all the way up to their knees. And we had, you know, low socks that where our calves were exposed. And they were all dressed identically, and it was intimidating. I say it's as if their uniforms were stitched with victory. And they did win that game, but we went on. Our coach was this enthusiastic man named Gary, who convinced us that we were going to be champions. And in two out of my years in grade school, we went to the championship. We didn't win the championship, but we were a really small school and a poor school. And no one ever would have expected us to go to the championship out of that league. In those days, Toledo had many, many Catholic parishes and Catholic schools. So we achieved quite a bit for what we were. But yes,
One thing that surprised me was you had to lose weight to play football.
Yes, in the league back then, there were rules about how big you could be because it was to protect the smaller children. So you couldn't be beyond a certain weight. So in order for me to be able to play on the team, I had to lose weight to make the weigh-in. Every kid had to go through the weigh-in. And so my coach bought these rubberized sweatsuits and put them on me and another boy, and we would run and just sweat it out so that we could make the weigh-in and be able to play.
Which is not really that good for kids. My son did that for wrestling.
Yes.
To cut weight for wrestling. And man, I hope they aren't still doing that, because people ruin their health. Young boys would ruin their health cutting weight to get to a lower weight class so they'd have a better shot at winning championships.
Yeah, my high school was a big wrestling high school. So a lot of my friends were always cutting weight to make the weigh-in. But that was a weekly thing where they had to make it for each match. Fortunately, in football, it was one time at the beginning of the season. And then you could gain all your weight back. So you didn't have to do it every week. So
that's good.
It wasn't as unhealthy as wrestling.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, you had a number of male role models and men who showed you kindness and helped you out along the way. You had, it seems like there were quite a few priests at the Catholic schools that you went to who were kind and kind of went the extra mile for you and people in your neighborhood. So you want to talk a little bit about some of them?
Yes. So I've already pointed out Coach Gary. A lot of the priests, you know, I questioned a lot about the Catholic religion in my youth because I had a very logical mind and I would see things that were inconsistent. So I talked to the priests a lot about those things that I saw. For example, the basic one being, we were taught continuously that God was all just. And I would say, well, if he's all just, what about all this injustice around us? And then I would proceed to point to individual cases that I could imagine occurring. And how can that ever be just? How could there, even if heaven is wonderful, we all go to the same heaven. So how can it be made up to the person that got murdered as a one-year-old child or something like that? You know, I create these scenarios. So I had that kind of mind, which is interesting unto itself. I think I was a strange boy. And then I began to go to the library, and there was a librarian, Mr. Barnett, who adopted me as his favorite every time I walked in the library, he would light up and help me with my work. As I said, I talked to a lot of the priests along the way. There's a famous, or there's an important scene to me where, it's not famous, but it's important to me, where, you know, I take the, all the siblings before me and my family went to public schools, high schools. They went to the elementary school at St. Vincent with me, but then they went to the local public high school, which was not a very good school. And I had this vision, once again, it shows how I'm different, I think. I had this vision that I would go to a Catholic school because the Catholic schools were the best academic schools in Toledo. And I figured out that if I kept my paper route that I had purchased from somebody and ran that, and if I worked some odd jobs and if I worked at the school, I could afford to go to Central Catholic, which is the cheapest of the Catholic schools in Toledo, the least expensive. And then I took the Catholic school's admissions test and I checked where I wanted my results to go, and I checked Central, like I said, and then I saw St. Francis on there. St. Francis is the all boys Catholic college prep school. In my neighborhood, it was known as the sissy school because you wore a coat and tie every day, et cetera. But I saw it as sort of the highest possibility. So even though I couldn't afford to go there, I checked the box. And several weeks later, I'm in my class at St. Vincent and I get called to the principal's office. And I'm worried because I think I've done something wrong. But there was a priest there, Father McMenamin from St. Francis de Sales High School. And he said, "Tell me, why did you check the box for Central?" And I explained how I had made this calculation. And this calculation I made was all on my own. It wasn't like, "Mom, what do you think of this?" or "Dad," or anybody or any of my teachers. I just really had control of my own life and believed I could do these things. And I explained how I could afford Central to Father McMenamin. And he said, "And why did you check St. Francis?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have because I can't afford it." And he said, "Well, I tell you, you can afford it because I can give you a full scholarship based on your test result."
Oh, boy.
I'm getting a little emotional because...
Well, so am I.
Yeah, it really was a huge turning point in my life because I was suddenly among, you know, a bunch of different kinds of boys. Boys who would go homes to, you know, families that talked about things around the table. And when we sat at lunch, we would talk about, you know, religion or world events and all these conversations I wasn't having back in my neighborhood or with my family. And so, and it was a very aspirational place where kids were all competing to be ranked highly in the class. And I was in the, back then they would put you into homerooms, and I was in the highest homeroom based on my test score. So I was with the most competitive academic boys. I was also a very good football player. So I, you know, I could hang out with the football guys or I could hang out with these nerdy guys. And I chose the nerdy guys, fortunately, look at that, and developed into quite a student there. Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So did your other friends from your earlier days, like the pumpkin throwing crew, did they defy the odds too?
So I don't know what happened to all of them. I don't even know some of their last names, so I couldn't even track them. I have tried to figure out what happened to some. I know one ended up in prison, but I don't know what happened to the others. But they didn't defy the odds well enough that I know that I can find them or know what happened to them, I would say. Wow. So, yeah, I've been asked that question, and I've really tried hard to find them.
Yeah. You do talk about some of, in your book, also some Black men who were role models for you.
Yeah. Well, they affected my life.
Or affected your life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, for example, Mr. Noble. By the way, these are not their real names. Mr. Noble, who lived across the street with his wife and three daughters in the projects as well. You know, he interacted with us sometimes, but he would, for example, if I was in a fight, he would pull the kids off me and save me. Or he took us fishing one time, which is one of the chapters, I've written a few chapters in the present tense in the book. The book is written in the past tense, and then suddenly you'll have a chapter in the present tense. And one of those chapters in the present tense is the chapter about when he takes us fishing and teaches us how to fish. And I see in him a better father figure. So yeah, there are moments like that. I have a black teacher, I don't remember what I named him in the book. I don't want to say. Mr. Everett. Okay. Thank you. I had to change the names at the last minute and I can't remember all the new names. But yeah, he was a very different teacher for me because he was, you know, connected into the sort of black world and what they cared about. And he would teach that to us and have us read things or talk about things that normally you wouldn't be talking about. So, you know, we knew who the Black Panthers were because I lived in Toledo, and Detroit is only 45 minutes north. And that was a place where there were a lot of riots taking place and a lot of activity, a lot of racial activity. So we had to stay in the house for certain periods in case things happened around us in our neighborhood. And what we would talk about those things, and he eventually got me to enter this speaking contest at a local college where I read a poem by a black author that was very different from what the other kids were doing at the speech contest. They were doing, you know, the Declaration of Independence or a typical sort of poem that you would do at one of those events. And so mine was very different. And I always sought his approval because I always liked to be the teacher's pet. And he was very difficult to win over. But I eventually won him over with
yeah. Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Tom Seaman, author of Animals I Want to See.
I wanted you to tell that story about the jack-o'-lantern and the little girl, a six-year-old girl, and what she said about that. Can you remember that?
Yeah, so that appears at the end of the book when we sort of I'm an adult now. And I serve on the board of directors of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Boston, which is about 11 clubs in Boston. And I'm on the board, I donate, but I wanted to point out that, you know, some of the most important stuff you can do is actually giving of your time. And so I was in one of the clubs and there was an art class and they were, you know, little kids. And I got to sit down with a little Mexican-American girl. And we talked a little bit and we were going to make a jack-o'-lantern. And so I tried to show her some of the techniques for making hers a little bit better, right? Which adults, of course, know. Plus, I'd like to think I had a little artistic flair. And I asked her, you know, how she wanted her jack-o'-lantern to be. And she said, what? And I said, how do you want him to feel? And so she said, I want him to feel loved. And so I, you know, looked at her and I wondered in my mind, sorry, I'm getting emotional again. You know, what's in her life? You know, what's her backstory that she would say that? And so, you know, we made a happy jack-o'-lantern with, you know, a gap tooth smile and all of that. So, you know, giving up your time to someone like that, I think, can be very important. You know, it can be one of those, once again, those small kindnesses that I received that maybe that one kindness didn't change a life, but the accumulation of all of them can.
And you try and do that every day.
I try to do an act of kindness for a stranger every day, although the opportunity doesn't always come up. You know, so sometimes I have to go home at night and do it for my family. Ha ha. My wife asked me, you know, did you do your act of kindness today so that she can get one out of me? Do those dishes. Yeah, I try to do an act of kindness. And some of that, sometimes it's a really big one where I give, you know, I've given a huge scholarship fund to my high school to try to seek kids who otherwise wouldn't go there. And they go out into the neighborhoods and they ask community leaders and teachers, do you have a student who probably could make it from St. Francis and it's probably not even on their radar? And then we identify those kids and bring them to St. Francis with scholarships. So given that scholarship, that's a huge act of kindness on that day. And maybe the next day, it's as small as letting someone in traffic. You know, which I used to be the guy that wouldn't always let someone in. And now I always try to. And because sometimes I'm the guy that needs to get in, right? But I also find that when you do an act of kindness every day, it actually makes you happier as well. I think writing this book made me a kinder person because I recognized as I started writing it, all these things that were done for me that I kind of knew were there, but when you actually put them on the page, they start to really add up in front of your eyes.
Wow, that's a very good recommendation for writing a memoir, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It makes you a kinder person, maybe.
Wow.
There was a gentleman who helped you get home when your father didn't pick you up. Do you remember that story? He gave you some money or something and showed you how to get there. I thought that was great.
So I was given, another thing I was given along the way, many things I was given was free art lessons at the Toledo Museum of Art, which is actually quite a good museum. And I would go on Saturday mornings to take these lessons. And my father was not a reliable guy because he would go to a bar and drink. And then there's a scene, this happened multiple times, but there's the scene where he first forgot to pick me up. And so I'm standing outside of the museum after the classes, and, you know, I'm with a bunch of young kids, and as their cars are pulling up, picking them up, I'm slowly getting more and more nervous as I count down the number of kids that are still left with me. You know, oh, there's at least 10 left. My dad's still coming. And eventually they're all gone, and I'm standing there alone crying with my piece of art in my hands from that week or whatever. And there's a black policeman who sees me and takes care of me by asking me where I live. And he recognizes the neighborhood, and he knows which buses I have to take to get there. So I'm this little kid, and he teaches me, get on this Collingwood bus that's going to pull up here, and you have to change downtown to the Stickney bus, and it will drop you off down Bronson Street away from my house, but I'll know where I am. And he gives me the money for the bus. And it's obviously a clear act of kindness, but it also then established in me this sense of independence because I knew that I knew how to get home if I had to from that point on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to do it again?
Yes. And the Toledo buses became a very big part of my life over time because it's how I got around. Either I had a bike that I bought with the money from my paper route, which I used to travel around a lot, even quite far distances. And then I used the Toledo buses. And when I was in high school, my high school, St. Francis, was right down the street from the University of Toledo. And I would go every night after football or after whatever I was doing and sit in the Toledo University of Toledo library, where they didn't have security back then, so I could just go in, right? And I would sit at the same table every night up in the stacks and do my work, including always extra calculus problems. I was very driven, as your mother said at the beginning of this call. I was a very driven guy, and I would sit until the very last Bancroft bus was going to run in front of the university, and I would go out there in the winter cold and get on that bus and then change downtown to the Stickney bus, the very last bus. And when I got home, you know, there was my mother ready to heat up the food from dinner for me. And this, I repeated this every single day.
The availability of public transportation can really make a difference to people's lives, can't it?
Yeah, it's a good point. Not something I had really written into the book or thought about. But yeah, without that, I don't know what I would have done, because I couldn't have stayed, obviously, without those buses.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that you and I are very similar age, by the way. So the times that you were writing about were very familiar to me. I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania at that time and then moved to Iowa in high school. But so one of the things that I really enjoyed was the thing about the encyclopedias.
Right.
And we had a set of encyclopedias at home, too. I don't know. They were always there. So I don't know when. Maybe, Mom, do you remember when you got the encyclopedias?
Oh, yes. We got those soon after we were married.
And was it from a door-to-door salesman?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so that scene is important because my mother couldn't afford those encyclopedias, but she still went for it. You know, we didn't buy much stuff at all because we didn't have any extra money after food. So my mother, this salesman, she let him in the house, which was a surprise. And he convinced her that maybe she could afford them because you only got a volume when you paid for it. So if she couldn't pay for it, she just wouldn't get the next volume, and she'd have to wait until she had accumulated enough money, I guess, to get the next volume. So you bought them volume by volume. And they became very, very important to me as a way to learn about the world, to see all, including seeing all these animals in there and stuff like that. But there's the scene where I see the pages about art, I see the pages about Poland because I'm part Polish, and it really opens up the world to me.
And those thin, thin pages.
Yes.
Yeah. And the one that had the anatomy in it, where did yours have the like plastic overlays of the veins and the bones? And that was always my favorite part.
I don't remember whether our volumes had that. I remember that from a book somewhere, maybe at school or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure our encyclopedias had that, but I remember what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I was thinking about like kids today, they have this wealth of information available to them in their devices and on computers. Those, I mean, not all kids are fortunate to have access to it, but those that do have this wealth of information. But I wonder if you're ever going to get that same feeling that you got from the encyclopedias.
I know. It was just opening them up and going somewhere in the encyclopedia and discovering something that you know, just accidentally come across or something, that was thrilling to me. Once again, I was an odd child.
I don't know.
I think it was, you know, I remember pouring through the encyclopedias and looking at things. And yeah, it was, there was just so much in there. It was,
yes. Yeah,
it was definitely a view to another world, to the bigger world.
And it was, you know, I quote in the book a few little sections or point out stuff because how they would state it, you know, they would talk about the Polish people and they would say, their clothing is drab and simple or something like that. You know, such a complete, you know, global statement about a people. You probably couldn't get away with that today. But
probably was, not. Probably not.
I still have those volumes. And
you
so
do?
Those things are actually out of the encyclopedia that I had as a child.
Oh, my goodness. Now, you mentioned that some of the sections of the book were written in present tense. What were you trying to accomplish with that? And there was also one that's written in second person. So what was it that you're trying to do with those changes in tense and person?
I would say, you, first of all, that was the influence of my writing coach, I have to admit, because she has a literary flair that I probably don't possess as well. But I'm learning. I've learned a lot from the process. I become a better writer through it. But we were trying to draw attention to and make it interesting for the reader, I think, but draw attention to certain things that maybe were not fitting exactly in time, or I didn't know exactly in my history when my father did the flagpole thing, the human flagpole, but wanted to have that in there as an example of something he did which impressed us as children, not just to be all negative about my father. We have the Christmas scene where, you know, I point out that my uncles were, my one uncle especially was really our secret Santa. He would, you know, a lot of the gifts that we got back then were not new things. He would buy used things and he had a shop and he would make them nicer and paint them. And we thought they were all new, and he would come Christmas night, which we didn't know. And he would help my mother wrap the gifts while my father slept upstairs, you know, or something. So, you know, just to show those examples of giving. But yeah, it's an attempt to draw attention to a few small episodes. And I think it adds interest to the book.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yes. Did you see all the animals you wanted to see?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've traveled over 100 countries in my life. And interestingly, my family, my kids actually enjoy this sort of, it's not a hobby, but this pursuit of mine to see different animals in the wild, you know. So we were in Panama and there was this very rare bird, the Quetzal bird, and it got the big blue plumes and we really wanted to see it. And so we were searching with the guide and finally found it. And I just remember everybody being thrilled, even when they were pretty little then, looking through binoculars, you know, Daddy, I see it, you know, so planting this seed early. I mean, everybody likes animals and everybody likes to see them, I think, in their natural habitat. But yes, but we still have we keep, you know, expanding the list. So our next idea is to go to Malaysia and see the orangutans in the wild. So that'll be quite a thrill. You know? Yeah, not, we always try to avoid seeing them. You know, you can go and you can see them at a rehab center or something, which is fun. But we always try to get to the point where we can see them in their own wild habitat. Yeah. Wow.
So, Tom, this book ends about the time you get into law school or get your law school admission exam.
Yeah.
Are you going to write a next, you know, continue from there?
You know, people have asked about that. You know, the reason the book ends there is because, you know, it might turn into, even though there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens later, it's true. But also, you know, it would be a little bit of a about my career, and I didn't want to make it into two different, you know, I wanted the readership to be clear that this is a coming of age story, an uplifting story, a happy story, but to sort of enter business in there, which, you know, because I became a business guy, right? And I started building businesses, and I worked at McKinsey & Company for a long time, and then I went and bought my first business, and fortunately I had success there, but it would be a very different book. Although, as I said, there's a lot that happened in my life that wasn't businessy as well. You'd have to have that business element because it was right. Such a big part of my adult life. So it would be a very different book. But I'll see how this book does.
Okay. All right. Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say we're out of time, unfortunately. Okay. So, but did you have something you wanted to finish up with there?
No, other than to say, you know, if I was to sum it up, you know, consider this, you know, act of kindness every day, or at least look back and recognize all the acts of kindness that were probably done for you, you know, to a reader, you know, I think that's an interesting idea. And the last thing would be this sense of wonder, you know, that we all lose as we age, and to try to see, because we have so many things weighing on us. And, you know, a lot of people think their life is very negative or it's a dead end life or something. And I think you got to let some of that go and see some of the wonder, see the good things that you do have.
Thank you, Tom. And Caroline, do you have some final words for us?
Well, see, I was going to say, that's what he said just now, that no matter every act of kindness, no matter how small, makes a difference. Wow. That was a quote from him.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you.